welcome to the Chelsea Skidmore Show. We are almost at the end of 2020. We did it, guys. We did it. We got through the year. I don't want to take my Christmas tree down. I love the ornaments. I love the color, the festivity. I am just staring at it right now. I'm seeing all my favorite ornaments, a typewriter, a ketchup bottle, an Eiffel Tower. It's very fun. I love it. This tree has brought the imagery of celebration for a hard year. And it's also been a really good year for me in a lot of ways. And, you know, outside of all the COVID stuff, it's been such a chance for me to turn inward, to pause on everything, to stop the chaos. You know, doing stand-up every single night, it was very fun, it was very busy, it was very chaotic. You know, I didn't really get time to really ground myself in my day because I was always thinking about, you know, future tripping on a show later that night and what was I going to do and say. And getting all of that kind of put on a timeout, getting to relax at home, write all day, cook, hang out with Jagger. Highly recommend getting a dog if you don't have one. Me and Steven have, you know, worked on our relationship and have grown together. I've done a lot of therapy and I am continuing, of course, to do therapy. I love therapy. I don't understand people who don't go to therapy unless you had a really great childhood. I'm not sure why you're not in it. If you aren't, you better get in it. And I have been spending the past couple weeks just doing some extra step work with my sponsor, some work on myself, going through the process of uncover, discover, and discard, and really looking at my life and, you know, my belief systems, trying to rewire my brain. So that's really cool stuff that I'm doing. And I am also, as the year comes to an end, in that reflection mode and thinking about how I want to make a couple of changes, some of them being my lack of hardcore exercise and diet. I mean, I definitely gained weight this year. I don't weigh myself because I used to have an eating disorder, so I don't like to step on a scale, but I know for sure it's been at least 5 pounds, at least easy 5 to 7. And, you know, a lot of the weight, some of it I hope is muscle. I did my friend Stacia's workout class a bunch and my ass is definitely a new ass. You know, I think genetically I have a flat ass because my mom has a flat ass. Sorry, mom, if you're listening, but it's time to do some squats. And Stacia's class definitely helped me build up an ass. Check out her. She has a Patreon now with all of the classes from this year uploaded. She teaches a lot of comics and girls in LA and all over the world, actually. So her classes, I think, it's $20 a month for her Patreon, and her classes are amazing. Big focus on the ass, but all other body parts as well. And it's great. I love it. So I need to do more of her workouts. I'm getting back on my walks. You know, it's up and down. I take a couple of days off from physical exercise if I'm writing all day and I like don't want to stop writing. And, you know, I thought I had COVID at one point, so I stayed inside resting. But then I got 2 negative tests, which was so strange because I was positive that I had it after I had been exposed to someone. But I don't know, I feel okay now. So I'm grateful about that because I really hate being sick. I just had one day where I had a 100.5 fever. But other than that, I was just really tired. But it was good to rest. I think that when someone gets an injury or an illness or is just really tired, it's a good time to listen to our body. And it's your body telling you to slow down. So I just slowed down and watched a bunch of thrillers. I love 90s thrillers. Saw The Firm, which I really liked. That was a fun one with Tom Cruise in the 90s. 90s thrillers are the best fucking movies. So I'm about to go on a walk after this, but I also am working on my diet, and I love flour, you know, bread, avocado toast, pasta. I have multiple times a week, so I'm going to try to bump that down to maybe like one cheat day a week and try to work on my diet. And I'm always looking for fun sort of hacks into what appear to be fun, naughty food, but they're actually healthy and not that bad for you. So I was super excited when I found out about Magic Spoon cereal. A friend of mine turned me on to it. And first of all, growing up, I loved Cinnamon Toast Crunch. I lived for Cinnamon Toast Crunch. I would have cereal for breakfast, lunch, and dinner well into college. And then I was like, I can't keep eating the sugar, and start eating croissants instead. Big change, right? And you know, now sometimes I have oatmeal and stuff and or avocado toast for breakfast, but I'm trying to eat something healthier. So Magic Spoon is really awesome because it basically feels like you're still getting that kid experience with cereal, but as an adult, because it's actually a lot healthier than normal cereals and it tastes good. I got their variety box, which has cocoa, fruity, frosted, and blueberry, four different flavors. I am obsessed with the cocoa flavor because I'm a chocolate person, but I do like the frosted as well. I still have to try the fruity and blueberry, but I know my husband has, and he really likes the fruity. But the cocoa is really good, and I have it with oat milk or almond milk, and it's good. It tastes like fucking chocolate. I'm eating a dessert for breakfast, but it's actually a healthy cereal. It's keto friendly. It's gluten free. It's grain free. It has zero sugar, which I was pretty shocked about because it's good. It doesn't taste like a healthy cereal, and the packaging is very fun. So you feel fun when you reach for it. It has 11 grams of protein and only 3 net grams of carbs in each serving. And I think there's something like 110 calories per serving too. So it's healthy. It's easy. I could just dump the box in a bowl with some almond milk while I'm on my computer in the morning. And it's good and it's fun. And I really fucking like it. So go to magicspoon.com/Chelsea to grab a variety pack and try it today. And also make sure you use the promo code Chelsea at checkout to save $5 off your order. I wanted to find a company that I really actually like and use. You know, sometimes I get sent things from people as gifts or whatever, but I really connect with Magic Spoon because honestly, I am the exact audience for it. I love having a fun breakfast cereal. I remember that people used to say that you should eat your sugar in the morning and get that out of the way because that's better for you. Like if you eat sugar before noon, you're good. So I would always have like multiple bowls of cereal Toast Crunch in the morning because I thought I was getting it out of the way. But now you can get your cereal in the morning and have it be healthy too and have zero sugar in it. So the cocoa, again, is my favorite. So check out Magic Spoon and see if you like it. And you save $5 on it with the code Chelsea. So that's my little gift to you. And also Magic Spoon, they're so confident in their product. It's back with 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money. No questions asked. You don't have to send back your food, but your half-eaten cereal. But if you don't like it, just let them know. So it's a super cool company. And that's Magic Spoon. .com/Chelsea and use the code Chelsea to save $5 off. And also, which is really great right now, you can order it online. It comes directly to your door. You don't have to go out to the market and wait on those long lines to get in and worry about, you know, who's sick and who's not and whatever. It's just a super fun, delicious cereal. And I hope you guys like it. And if you do like it, please let me know because I will feel like I did something great in the world. This episode is very exciting. It has India Oxenberg, who is a NXIVM survivor. I was so happy she came on. India is the star of a docuseries on Starz called Seduced Inside the NXIVM Cult. Her story is also shared on The Vow on HBO, which is another documentary on NXIVM, which was a cult that India was in for 7 years. So it's super awesome that she came on and shared her story. I really liked her a lot. She was really awesome and such a great, open, vulnerable, honest interview. So I think you guys will really like it. So enjoy the episode and I will see you in 2021. Hi, India.
Hello.
Hi.
having me.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I'm so grateful to have you on. I just finished watching Seduced probably like 2 months ago. And so it's really exciting to talk to you. We were just briefly touching on The Vow and Seduced. And first of all, I feel like we should explain to the listeners, if they haven't watched either documentary, if they aren't completely aware of NXIVM, I want to let you kind of explain who you are and your involvement, just to lay that out there.
Okay. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to chat. Basically, NXIVM was a criminal organization that proposed and explained themselves more or less as self-help. And that was the way that they were able to conceal a lot of their criminal activity, by having fronts and kind of consumer-friendly products that they sold to people. One of which was executive success programs that I took with my mother back in 2011. My name is India, and I grew up here in Southern California. And I unfortunately found myself in the belly of a beast, which was Keith Raniere. I spent 7 years in NXIVM, two of those years very intensely in a group called DOS, which was a secret sorority of women that was intended to be, or let's rephrase that, not intended to be, but was pitched to me as a female empowerment group. And ultimately what I learned it was a funnel in which women were being groomed for Keith Raniere to be used as sex slaves, but also as pawns for his bigger, greater world domination scheme. And I know that sounds really crazy and weird and sci-fi, but that's the type of man that we were dealing with, someone who is really an extreme narcissist and has quite a challenging pathology for even me to understand. So it's taken me a while to figure out who I was dealing with for the past 7 years of my life.
Yeah, I'd say like what really stood out to me was your inner strength and the way that you advocated for yourself and the vulnerability that you had. And what I really loved about Seduce specifically was like, it's, you know, straight from your point of view. And it was, and I felt like the way that you were able to speak about everything that happened, which was obviously very traumatic, like I thought you really presented yourself in such a strong way. And I was really, I have like the chill saying this, because I feel like, you know, so many people have been through horrible experience. It's not easy to talk about. Like, I first want to like say that, like, you know, I personally was involved with the whole Harvey Weinstein thing. And I was one of the, you know,
I understand completely.
In a different way, you know, I don't want to in any way like compare myself to you. It's like under the same umbrella of like, you know, of
predatory behavior.
Exactly. So like for me personally, like I literally had one interview, and that with the Washington Journal, and then that gets blasted out to everywhere. So like I was a part of this ride. I did one podcast. That's literally all I did, but my story was duplicated so much. And I had a really hard time with the aftermath of everything. And what felt like cathartic conversations turned into a lot of like hate message. Yeah, don't do it. Turned into like a lot of hate messages from strangers. And like, so
who do you think you are?
Yes.
You liked it. I mean, there's so much victim shaming. It's sick. And I that was one of the things. It is not easy to talk about this thing, first of all, alone with a therapist, hard. Then on top of it, to speak to the FBI for 9 months plus and go through everything over and over again in a very linear way. And if you've ever worked with the government, or if you've ever had to be a cooperating witness, you know that that is not a glamorous experience. Mm-hmm. And it's not the way that they paint it on TV shows at all. It takes a lot out of you. And I think for me, there was a point where I hadn't, I mean, when you're a cooperating witness, you're told you do not speak to anybody. You are literally siloed. And so I was processing what I had just gone through with strangers for the first time. I had never really spoken about this stuff. So when it came to actually telling my story, that took a while to make that decision. I was not interested in speaking about this at all. I thought, I remember my now fiance, then boyfriend, we our house burned down in the Woolsey fires in 2018. And so from there, another cherry on the top that was like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, how can this get any worse? And so we lose everything and we relocate to Colorado. And from there, I'm going from Colorado to New York, Brooklyn specifically, to work with the FBI. Not allowed to talk to anybody. And I'm coming back to Colorado in the midst of winter. And I'm literally like, what the fuck is going on? Because all of these memories started to come up that were dormant for years. All these things that I had suppressed that were coming up while I was working with the FBI. And then I would come home to my poor boyfriend at the time and just be a wreck, like so messy, processing all of this stuff, trying to figure out if I was a freaking monster. And then on top of it, we're just kind of starting to get to know each other. I'm telling you, you have literally gotten me at my worst. Aww. And I didn't know when that was going to end. Yeah. And I think anyone who has experienced trauma or any kind of difficult situation can relate to just this tumultuous feeling of confusion and not knowing how you're going to move on and how you're going to get through it. And so I was kind of stuck in that place, reeling in my own head, feeling totally depressed and suicidal.
Of course.
And thinking, I don't ever want to talk about this. Mm-hmm. I want this to disappear. I'm going to change my goddamn name. And I'm going to, I was babysitting at the time, which was like my only sense of relief was working with kids, because otherwise when I was alone, I was like miserable. So I get why a lot of people don't speak out, because you're met with both the social judgment of, other people's opinions about you. And then on top of it, you're going through your own shit. And that's hard enough. So really for me, it started with writing. And that was kind of like my only way privately to get what was going on inside of me out. And then from there, I took some time to just focus on my healing. And it wasn't until months later that Cecilia Packin and Ball Lesner, the two creators and co-producers with me, even gave me a call to talk about what was then just Untitled Women's Project, which then became Seduced. And I was scared and I was nervous to put myself out there. I didn't know that I was going to be like the centerpiece of the docuseries at the time. But the more we started to share about my experiences and the way that I could explain what happened in NXIVM and what NXIVM was, we began to work together. And it was a safe and respectful environment. It was pretty much entirely women-led. And so I kind of started to open up there. I hadn't spoken to anyone besides my closest family or the FBI until then.
Had you been working with a therapist before? Okay, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a huge advocate for therapy.
Of course.
But when I first came out of NXIVM, I was really creeped out by therapy, because a lot of the techniques that they used were kind of like butchered versions of, therapeutic processes. So even talk therapy really irked me. And I was like, no. So I was resistant for a while. And then there came a point where I was like, okay, I need a professional.
Yeah, I could see how that would feel triggering. Because it probably reminded you of, is that sort of like what they would do with an EM?
Yes.
I know all the terms.
It felt like manipulation. I know, I love it. It was like an EM, but even just the thought of being questioned and led somewhere felt icky to me. And I had to rebuild my trust that there were good people who actually cared and were not going to try to use or exploit me. Because before, when I had left Albany and relocated to New York City to try to find a job, basically, because I was, everything around me was falling apart. And I thought, well, if I can just keep a job, maybe this thing will pass.
Yeah.
That's like kind of how I was thinking about it, and not, but that was kind of my way of just taking care of myself in the best that I knew how. And I wasn't ready to talk at all about experiences. I could barely, I mean, it took me more than 6 months after leaving to even say that something sexual had happened. So that's how deeply buried these things can be.
Yeah.
So it was a long process to even get there.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel? Did you watch it? Seduced?
Yes.
Are you happy with how it came out?
I'm really happy about how it came out, and I'm really pleased with the things that I was able to do as an executive producer and make sure that Jane Does were concealed, that minors were blurred, that people were protected. We even offered therapy to anybody who worked on our project, either as a subject or on the crew.
That's amazing.
So we wanted to make sure that people were really cared for. Mm-hmm. And that was very important to me because I had just come out of a very horrible experience with the media where I felt like I was totally blindsided, and it was scary for me, and I didn't want anybody to feel that way.
Yeah, of course. Well, yeah, I'm again, like, I think it's amazing that you did it, even though if it was uncomfortable, I think it really helped like so many people. And I'm sure a lot of other members of the group who, you know, might have like disappeared kind of and are dealing with what you're dealing with. But you know, standing up and being that voice for them, I'm sure it's going to help them into therapy and walk through it too. So that's awesome.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I started with a deprogrammer though, which sounds really weird and like kind of sci-fi, but the deprogrammer was, her name is Diane Benscooter. And that was before I did any therapy, and we just talked, and all she would do is ask me questions. And a good deprogrammer is intended to rebuild your critical thinking so that you can think for yourself and not think in that closed loop of what the indoctrination was trying to teach you, like, oh, this is good, this is always good. Like,
yeah,
it's very difficult to break out of that mindset. So she helped me do that, and then from there, I tried a whole bunch of other therapies and different things to see what would work and what would help.
Yeah. And was part of that sort of learning more to trust your gut? Because I'm sure like along the way, your gut probably was telling you that something was off, but then there would be someone else there kind of, you know, talking you out of it. Is that kind of...
Exactly. Totally. You hit the nail on the head.
And I feel, you know, I feel like so many people can relate to that. It's like you can be in a bad relationship with a guy who, you know, like sucks and you don't want to be with him. And then you'll rationalize it in your head. Mm-hmm. And like, you'll just ignore that voice. I'm still like trying to really work on, like, I feel like it's like a constant process. And I don't know if that's something from like childhood, you know, like, or not you specifically, but like with anyone with their intuition, like, where along the way that can get lost for some of us. But like, that's like a constant thing that I'm like, you know, sometimes I really have to like all like automatically want to like text people and be like, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? And it's like, no, like sit by yourself, like, and like really like take it in.
I have to do that all the time. Like the amount of text messages that don't go through are quite high. And
that's part of the work.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's part about trusting yourself and knowing that you know shit too. Mm-hmm. Like you, and that your feelings are valid. And for me, while I was in NXIVM, intuition was strongly discouraged. I mean, it was, they used to say, well, it's pseudoscience. Like, how can you even prove it? So they were very strategic about what they diminished and what they promoted. Oh, logical thinking, data, all the shit that they were trying to get us to believe, which ultimately a lot of us did, had us diminish our intuition and our feelings to our guts. The EM specifically disconnected you from your feeling about things. And what, the feeling is in your body.
Right.
So, and I know that's crazy to think, but imagine like there's a stimulus outside of you. Like every time your boyfriend raises his eyebrow, you get scared. Mm-hmm. So in an EM, they would break that stimulus response so that you didn't feel that scary feeling when your boyfriend raised your eyebrow. And you think, oh my God, I'm liberated of this problem. Thank you so much. I feel so much more capable of handling the world around me. What you don't realize is that you're actually becoming more numb to things. Because they're disconnecting that feeling. So that can be used, that tool can be used maybe for your benefit, but mostly it was used so that people were less dependent on the things outside of them and solely dependent on Nexium.
So I'm sure there was like a lot of and I'm sure you kind of had to de-thaw from some of that stuff too. And like in getting back in touch with like feeling your feelings and all that stuff too, and knowing it's okay to feel that.
Feeling my gut.
Yeah.
Right.
It seemed like.
And also to trust it.
Mm-hmm. Is there any.
That was
like,
hard.
Yeah. Is there any specific things that you can recall that you learned in therapy that I mean, like, I feel like it's easier said than done, like trust your gut. Like, are there any sort of, it's like, great. How do I do that?
You know, we should get little pins, like trust your gut. It's like, oh yeah. Okay. But really it's practice. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of things that different therapists said to me that were helpful. And I think for one, it's just been finding the right kind of formula that makes me feel better. And a lot of that has to do with exercise and physical activity. Like, I really rely a lot on that because sometimes I don't really want to talk about it anymore. And I just want to punch the shit out of something. And that's okay. Cause that's how I process things. And I guess for me, I was kind of judging that, oh, I have to do it this way, or I have to read that book, or I have to talk to that therapist. And that's not true. Like, trust your timing.
Were you someone who was into like searching for the answer kind of thing before you got into Nexium?
Yes and no. Mm-hmm. I mean, I grew up here in Los Angeles, and it's like the mecca of personal growth and self-help. So there was a part of me that was kind of like, ugh, not another workshop.
Yeah.
And then I also, I was like, I don't want to go to your orgasm retreat right now. Like,
wait,
there were
I have
a
two
lot
friends
of-
who did one of those. Have you heard of that one?
Oh, yeah. I've heard of a lot of them.
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
Yeah, there's wild shit out there. Some of it's great and some of it's snake oil. So you just have to kind of determine that for yourself, sadly. Mm-hmm. But also trusting people to give you good, incredible resources and doing your own research, which for Nexium, my mom and I did not do.
Yeah.
So we just trusted our friend, and our friend recommended it to us. She was that friend that, you know, how you always have the girlfriend that tells you where to eat, what to watch, where, like, who to sleep with, who to not sleep with. She was like that woman for us, but with personal growth. So my guard was already kind of down.
Yeah, I noticed like that there was like a lot of Buddhas in your house. So like what the or your mom's house. So it's like, okay, like they're a family who loves like spirituality. Like it totally makes sense, you know, like how it's like, oh, cool. What's this thing? Like, not that Buddhas mean anything, but like, you know, you could just, I just feel like it's like if you're already like a
have a crystal on my desk.
There's so
right
many
now,
crystals to the left of me. I just can't reach them.
I mean, but I love it all. I think.
Yeah, me too.
I consider myself someone sort of spiritual, and like that to me is a very personal thing. I think it's something great. I've relied on something bigger than myself a lot, especially recently when I feel overwhelmed, and so I do consider myself a spiritual person. I think it does make sense that we would be open to that, but there were plenty of people in Nexium specifically who didn't have that background. So it's always kind of an interesting thing to look at, like, how did that person get there? And what was their particular vulnerability, or what was the hole that they were trying to fill? And it's not like we're talking about super broken people. Mm-hmm. We're talking about people who just want to be better.
Totally. And like I'm sober, you know, so I'm in a bunch of 12-step programs. And it's like before that, like I, you know, when I was like fucked up, I never thought about like trying to improve myself. But once I got sober, it's like this whole world opens up. And then it's like, you want to keep uncover, discover, discard, you know, figure out how you can improve and make things better and like fill that God-sized hole, you know, some say. And like, yeah. I feel like everyone, as people in the world, we all want that like fix it button. We all want to like flip the switch and like be good to go. And like, I noticed that some of the programs in Nexium and some of the teachings and what I saw, like it looked good. Like despite all of the negative aspects, like I'm so curious about the teachings and like if you learned any tools or like if it was beneficial to you outside of all of the horrible stuff, like the program itself and like what you learned. Like, I'm so curious about that.
That's a good question. Because there has to be enough good for people to want to stay. Like, why would, if the curriculum, and I'm using air quotes, because really a lot of what they did was just stolen from other modalities, and you could find that in a credible self-help book.
Yeah.
But they, what they did was use other people's styles. Mm-hmm. And the way that they packaged it was very well marketed, and they used people of influence or status to recruit other people, so it gave it legitimacy. I learned a lot, and I don't discount that, because one of the main things that I've had to work on with a therapist is not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Mm-hmm. Like, an experience is so multifaceted that it can be bad, but you can learn so much from it. I don't think that their curriculum itself is good, because at its core it was created by Keith Raniere and he was using it for a bad intention, but I definitely learned a lot of things that I could have learned elsewhere, but I happened to learn them in Nexium, and they help me even now, strangely, because they're regular things that you kind of need to learn to be
like
a grown-ass
person. Like what?
like personal responsibility, or having control of your emotions, or being someone who doesn't blame and actually looks at the world as like, how did I get involved with this? How did I become responsible for this decision? All of those things were the types of questions that you might talk about in an Nexium course. Like, what is responsibility? How are you responsible for this outcome? How about that? But they took it to the extreme where there were no victims of anything. And that's not true. But that was part of their indoctrination, was to show you how you couldn't be victimized, so that they could kind of do whatever they wanted to you, and it would be in the name of self-help.
Yeah, I know it's probably
hard. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I know it's probably hard to guess, but do you think it started out like innocently and he grew like hungry with power? Or do you think this was like all a part of a master plan?
Oof, that was one of the hardest things that I had to grapple with after I left, because I really wanted to convince myself that it was innocent and went awry. And what I realized as I did more research once I left was that that wasn't the truth, that actually Keith Raniere had been doing these things to young women for decades, and minors as well. And even back in the 90s, he created an MLM that stole a lot of money from people called CBI. And I even learned while filming Seduced that one of the women that we interviewed was a former girlfriend of his, that 20 years plus, he gave a contract, a master-slave contract to her to be in a sexual relationship. And when I heard that, my mouth dropped and I was like, holy shit, wow. He has been doing this for years. He's been preparing these sort of sick ideas that he wanted to do for years. And this was just the right time and experimental group that he practiced on.
Wow.
That's the kind of person that he is. So I like to think that I wanted to think that it was more innocent than it was, but I learned that it wasn't.
Well, it's good that you, you know that and can look at that honestly and, you know, be in acceptance of that. Cause I'm sure that's like, you know, a big, yeah, I'm sure that's big and hard. And I totally get how like,
it's hard.
It's like hard to process. It's like being blindsided, but not, you know?
Yeah, and it's difficult to see yourself as someone who made decisions that endangered yourself and other people, because nobody wants to be that kind of person. I mean, if you are, you're doing it. If you aren't, I mean, for us, a majority of the people that were in Nexium were good people. So they weren't looking to exploit one another. It was really mostly the top tier of the organization that knew what they were doing.
So, people like Nancy as well. Like, I feel like there's not enough blame on her. Like, I feel like it seemed like she kind of got away with more. I mean, because it kind of seemed like they obviously, like, Keith is like in charge of everything, but it kind of seemed like it was them two together.
Oh, for sure it was. Yeah. He couldn't have had Nexium. He could not have had ESP or Nexium without Nancy Salzman or Clara Bronfman's money.
Right. So they must have known everything, like all of the evil master plan sort of thing.
I think they knew a lot, but another thing that I learned about these types of groups, and they were charged under a RICO status, which is similar to the mafia. And what they did that was smart, and I don't like giving them a ton of credit, but they were smart at this, is that they compartmentalized information so that only a couple people knew some things that Keith was doing, then the others were enforcers of his positive propaganda. Then maybe another group was recruiting and another group was just there to look pretty and make people feel comfortable. Like, that was how he did things, and he structured them, and he used people depending on what they could bring. And for one, Claire brought the money, Nancy brought the, you know, the brainchild of the self-help, you know, history that she had with NLP, and many other people brought value to him that he used for his own benefit.
How,
but all very strategic.
Yeah. How did, from an insider perspective, it seemed like everyone was very like Keith was very alluring to everyone on the inside. Like, I can understand when you're in that kind of bubble, like, you know, what was it about him? Like, did you understand it at first, or was it something you like grew to? Because I know you're like under a spell, sort of, so to speak. Like, I'm sure.
Yes.
Like, what is it about him that everyone found so interesting?
Similar to Miramax and Harvey Weinstein, actually, I think one of the things that he did was that he created the propaganda that he wanted people to believe about him. So when I first came in, I was just a student. I really didn't know anything about Keith. And you don't meet him until you go to Albany, which means you've already done an extensive amount of curriculum. So you're kind of, you're being indoctrinated, but you're not aware of it. And you're being coerced. Well, that's like the definition of coercion. You're being led in a direction that you're not aware that you're going. And part of that is to idolize Keith. And so, and at first I was like, I don't care about this guy. Like, I came here to do the class. Like, he's just this tiny little guy playing volleyball. The first time I met him, he was playing volleyball. And I was like, unimpressed.
And did he suck? Like, petty, did he suck? Wait, did he suck at volleyball?
No, you...
No. I was dying to know if everyone, I was dying to know if everyone had to pretend he was good.
Oh my God. That would be so funny. Like, the, like, if he was a king or something and everyone had to pretend that he was good at volleyball. He was actually pretty good at volleyball. He's an athlete. Blah, blah. But he is, I played volleyball in high school. And so they were always trying to get me to play. And I, there was something about it. I was like, even when I was in DOS, I was like resistant to the volleyball stuff. And I played one time with him, and he's good. He's a setter. He can get the ball up. Not anymore, because he's in jail. But and so for me, I was not impressed with him. It wasn't until like years of additional indoctrination that I started to feel an admiration for him. And, you know, a desire to express my gratitude to him. Like, that all came later. And then when I was in DOS, you had to be nice. Like, you had to comply with his demands. That's how you stay unpunished. I mean, that doesn't really last very long, but that's why I hope that it came across in the series that this stuff isn't anything that happens overnight. Like, mm-hmm, this is a mm-hmm. long period of grooming that I think people who have experienced other predators like Jeffrey Epstein's or the Harvey Weinstein know that it's not like 1 minute and then you're in bed with the guy. It's he's breaking down barriers with you slowly with his knowledge that there's going to be a point where you're going to break and mm-hmm. that he's going to have you in the palm of his hands. And that's what these types of people do. So,
and it seemed like, he seemed like one of those kind of guys who had like an answer for everything, you know? So I'm sure like when you're kind of under that spell, like it probably does seem like he really knows a lot and that you're learning a lot from him. And that whole like kind of guru disciple relationship, I feel like he played pretty well.
Very well. I mean, I thought he was my friend. Mm-hmm. I actually believed that we were close and that he knew many things about me that other people didn't know. He used to share with me that he was dyslexic and I'm dyslexic. So there were things that he was trying to bond over with me. And there was an emotional connection there, but it was very much like a disciple guru dynamic. And that lent itself very well to DOS because mm-hmm. of this master slave structure.
Mm-hmm. Did you see like any sort of like hint of like, did you have an opinion about him at any point on your own? And then you were like, I can't think that, I was swayed.
Yes. I remember one day we were on a walk and he started to tell me about his girlfriends. And I was like, okay, why are we talking about this? Like, it really kind of it felt like it was out of left field. Like, I'm not the kind of girl that also really registers if someone's hitting on you right away. Like, sometimes too. I have to be like, someone has to tell. Yeah.
Someone's
really hitting on you. Yeah, exactly. I'm like that. There were. So this was one of those moments, unfortunately, with Ranieri, where I didn't really get what he was trying to sell. And he said to me, you know, I require, what was his words? He said, I require monogamy with my partners, but I'm polyamorous. And they all know this and they all agree to this. And I remember looking at him like, what? Like, why are you telling me this? And what I didn't realize at the time was he was kind of asking me to be okay with that, to be a girlfriend. But I had no desire to be his girlfriend, not at all. Like, for me, I wasn't sexually attracted to him. Every time he would touch me, I would recoil. And I blamed myself, mm-hmm. thinking, oh my God, what's wrong with you? You're so defected because you don't feel comfortable around this guy. But really, those were my instincts that I was overriding. And it was in that moment that I started to change my opinion about him slightly, because I realized that he just wanted what he wanted. But I also couldn't really think that because I was in DOS and I had to see him as this good person with ultimately good intentions. And so I kind of just buried that in the background and didn't even think about that conversation until I was with the FBI and I told them that story. And they're like, didn't you think that was strange? And I was like, I didn't even register that was his invitation into this harem. And so there were many moments like that. And unfortunately, if you questioned or if you were negative or not supportive of Keith or DOS or anything, you were punished, mm-hmm. and usually verbally or physically.
Yeah.
And that was DOS, and DOS was another level.
Were you happy in DOS, or did you feel like you got into this thing and now there's collateral? And like, were there moments of it that you enjoyed, or did you kind of just, did that start to make you feel more trapped? And like, kind of like put the pressure cooker, like kind of,
yeah,
whatever that analogy would be.
I wish. No. I really wish that I had been. I wish that I had felt afraid of what was going on while I was in there. But there were really only a couple moments that I remember feeling fear. And that is because anytime, excuse me, anytime that we would feel a reaction to DOS or to what we were being asked to do, we were told to get an EM on it. So there was very little fear that I was feeling because it had all kind of been buried and diminished with the EMs. So it wasn't until afterwards that I started to feel the fear appropriately of all the blackmail that they had over me. And that wasn't until I left and I began having panic attacks because I was out and I could start to feel again. So there were many moments in DOS where I thought that I was just having fun with my friends and that I believed in what we were doing and I believed what we were doing was good. That was not the case for everybody. There was one woman in my group specifically who pretty much from the time that she committed was questioning and was feeling trapped and terrified. And every time she would come to Albany, she would just cry in Allison's living room. And they would send me over to her and be like, make her feel better. Like, tell her all the good things about DOS. And I'd be like, okay. So innocently, I would go over there and I'd be like, I'm sorry that you're not feeling so good. Like, what's going on? How can I help you? And that was the way that I was used in a lot of ways, was to make people feel comfortable and normalize things like a lure to bring in other women that I was totally unaware that I was being used for that purpose. And I mean, I've obviously felt enormous amount of guilt over that, but I also now see what was going on. Yeah. A lot better than before. So no, there were moments where I was like, this sucks. I hate it. I'm starving and I'm hungry and I'm tired and I'm cold and I don't want to do this and I don't want to go to volleyball. And like, there were many moments like that, but it was overridden with this intense positivity and feeling of friendship and camaraderie that I thought I was building.
Why was volleyball at like 3 a.m? Why were the walks at like 3? Why was everything like, how did he have so much energy? Like, did he take Adderall?
He slept all day long.
Oh, okay. I was so curious about his energy levels because I'm like, I don't have energy for any of this.
I think mostly what happened was we were being told that he, you know, worked nonstop and that he slept very little. That was the internal propaganda going around. But really what I learned afterwards was that most of the time he slept during the day and then did what he wanted to do at nighttime. And part of that was to show your willingness to be uncomfortable. So you would show up at volleyball when it was cold, when it was late. It was the last thing that you wanted to do in your day, but you were loyal. So you would show up. And that was just one other kind of check mark to verify how loyal you were. And the walks were that too.
Has that, and also how is there always like a recording of the walk? I'm so curious
because
about that.
He wanted that. So anytime he was talking or sharing new ideas, sorry, it makes me laugh, but because they're not new ideas, he wanted it to be tracked. So he would have things filmed. He would have things recorded. He would insist that other people do it. And that was part of his narcissism. Was yes. thinking, oh my God, I'm changing the world. So I need to track all of this for the future to be able to listen to me. I mean, like now, if I listen to anything Keith Raniere related, I'm like, what the fuck is this guy even saying? Like it all sounds so crazy to me. But back then I was trying so hard to do well in the program that I made it make sense. I made it make sense for me too a lot.
Would he be like, grab your phone. Like I got a good thing. Like I got something good going. Like that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, do you have your phone? Do you have your phone? We should record this. It's like, okay, here we go. You know, we're solving the problems of the world. Solving the problems of the world from Clifton Park. Here we are with Keith Raniere. It's like, no.
And would he have people
like words?
Would he have people transcribing his recordings?
Yeah, he did. He had people transcribe them. He had people turn them into articles that he would then circulate or want printed. I mean, he really thought he was, I think he still does, like sort of a messiah.
Wow. Yeah. I think there's like some mental illness with that. I mean, besides the narcissism and like the sociopath and psychopath behavior, I think like people like really believing, like one of my thoughts was like, oh, he's just doing the same thing in jail right now. Like, I'm sure he's finding inmates and like manipulating them and like, you know, and I'm, you know, everyone there is in a vulnerable place. Like, I'm sure he's just finding his new version of that. Like, I feel like these people just kind of keep going.
They do. And I even saw that when I read my victim impact statement, because that was the first time that I spoke to him since he was arrested.
In court.
Yeah. Wow. And that was back on October 27th. I spoke with 14 other people who shared their truths. And it was kind of extraordinary to watch his responses, because it was like nobody was there. He's incapable of feeling empathy. And I went in there knowing that, but I also didn't think that I would be that shocked by it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was actually affirming, because I realized, I'm not special. Like, he is literally incapable of feeling any empathy for people. So even as we shared, we really shared for us, and we shared for the judge in the hopes that he would get life in prison, which he did. So it worked, but it was also extraordinary to see how much someone will not accept reality when they're in that kind of narcissistic bubble. Like, he was still calling us liars when we were speaking out. So it was shocking. But it's also not shocking, because that's how they are. Yeah. They'll go down kicking and screaming to the end of the earth to prove that they're right and someone's wrong. And that also, I mean, that's also why I think he got 120 years. He's not safe to be in society.
Absolutely. What was that like reading the victim statement? Like, did you feel, I'll just let you tell me instead of trying to guess.
you could guess away. It was a mix of emotions.
Yeah, but that makes sense.
It was intense. And I could have given a lot of excuses, but I made a pact with my friend who also spoke, who I love dearly. And she's been just such a pillar of strength for me. She's a Jane Doe, so she stays private. But I was like, okay, I'll go if you go. But it's COVID, like, everything is working against us. I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to go to New York. And so when I spoke, I kind of had to just coach myself through it the day before I actually flew in. And then the next day I spoke at sentencing. I kept telling myself, like, okay, anybody can do anything for 8 minutes. Like, anyone can do anything for 8 minutes. It's only 8 minutes. Like, I recorded it so I would know. I was ready in my little Airbnb practicing. I was like, God damn it, I wish I had a sedative. Like, like, I was really, really nervous.
And yeah, of
I was like,
course.
It's too early to drink wine. Like, anything. It was so uncomfortable. And I didn't know what to expect. And so I just didn't want to think about it. I was just get there and read it and do it. And I was I was in the middle of the queue of people who spoke. And I was shaking, for sure. I was shaking. And I just made the decision last minute that I was going to address Keith to his face, and I was also going to speak to the judge, because I didn't know if I was going to be able to look at him.
Yeah.
But I did. And I just made certain points very clear when I said them to him, because I wanted them to land, whether he's not going to feel it. But
That's
it was
amazing.
Really just for me.
Yeah.
And it was my way of just, like, getting these things out of me with words. And I felt really calm afterwards, like, strangely calm. And then it took me about 2 weeks to kind of feel normal again after that. I didn't realize that it was going to take so much out of me emotionally. And I didn't have a break, because I was still in the middle of this whole press run with Seduced. I came back, and the next day, I think I did, like, Good Morning, I don't know, Good Day LA, whatever it was. It was a blur. It was some morning news channel, and they're like, how was it? I'm like, I literally just got back into a COVID test, so here we go.
Yeah.
So I feel like these past couple weeks to having a little bit more downtime has been nice, because I've been able to kind of process what just happened.
What have you been doing for self-care?
Let's see, a lot of cooking at home. That's fun for me, and my fiance is a chef, so that really helps. with the self-care and cooking element.
Yeah.
And I have been taking a lot more baths. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I even find that in the middle of the day, if I have like a couple podcasts or calls, I'll just get in the bath with some Epsom salts, and that's really like relaxing. I have my two kitties, so I take breaks, petting breaks with them. And what else have I been doing? I've been doing a lot more boxing these days, which I'm enjoying. And that's kind of my version of self-care. It's a weird one, but it works for me. And I have also been rereading a book called The Body Keeps the Score.
I have that.
Which I recommend for, yep, I thought you would. I recommend anyone who has had trauma read it, because I feel like he's talking to me the whole time. And it's just really enlightening, and it's helped me understand myself a lot better.
Yeah, I have it on audiobook and paperback. And for some reason, it's been hard for me to open, because I was worried that if I open up this book, it was going to open up this whole like crazy thing. But it's not.
I felt that way, and yeah. I avoided the book. Mm-hmm. I just started. I avoided the book for a long time because my mom was always like mothers do, you should read this, you should read yeah. this, you should read this. I'm like, no, not another self-help book, please. And then I actually cracked it open, and then I also got the audio, and so I've been listening to that. And it's a lot. I need to take breaks from it. It's really dense, but it is helpful.
Yeah. I'm sure at the time, like when your mom was doing everything she could to try to get you out, like I could totally see it being like, my mom is so fucking, you know, like your mom trying to like pick you up from a high school party and you're like so fucking embarrassed kind of thing.
that is how I felt while I was in.
Yeah.
I was just like humiliated and betrayed. And I felt like everyone was looking in my underwear drawer, and I felt totally exposed. And I was also getting a lot of influence from the NXIVM higher ups, mm-hmm. telling me, your mom's a psychopath. She's trying to destroy you. She's going to try to hurt you. She has Munchausen's by proxy. Like, they were telling me all this crazy shit about my mom that at moments I was like, wait a minute, this is my mom. This is my mom who raised me. My mom is not a sociopath. Like, I know my mother. But I was also so confused and really vulnerable at the time that I trusted these people, and I believed a lot of the things that they were saying about my mom, like, oh, she's just trying to reinvent herself and all of that. Mm. But there was always this little piece of me that was like, I don't know. I don't know. And I kept a hope that we would resolve this. I thought at the time, oh, this is just a problem that my mom and I need to deal with, and we'll get over it. I didn't see it as a much bigger thing. That's what my mother saw, and that I couldn't see because I was too close inside of the bubble.
Yeah. You probably also didn't even see some of that.
And right. I was discouraged from reading. I was discouraged from reading it. I was discouraged from watching her on the news. It was also really scary because I was getting lots of calls for people. There were reporters in the neighborhood, and I was being told to not talk to anybody, including my mom.
How did it feel after watching and having, when you had a different perspective on everything, like to see like how incredible and how, you know, how much she loves you and fought for you? Like, was that, I'm sure that was an incredible feeling to see it from like a different, did you have like a change of heart kind of with it all?
Well, in stages, yes. Mm-hmm. So throughout, even through, we were healing even through the filming of Seduced. And oh. So up until this point, when we started to do press together, it was like just this extraordinary amount of gratitude that I felt for my mom and what she did for me and what she was willing to sacrifice, that it makes me want to cry now,
of
because
course, yeah.
I just don't think that I knew how much she loved me. And that was just so affirming, and also felt like we just had such a deep respect for each other, because we knew now why, in a spiritual way, like why we had to do what we did. Hmm. And even though I was, you know, one of the last men standing, if you will, she knew that she had to fight it from the outside and I had to fight it from the inside. And there was something kind of healing and understanding that it wasn't about us being, you know, against each other. It was actually us working for the same team, mm-hmm. just didn't feel or look like that at the time. And so we have grown a lot as a mother daughter, and I just feel so lucky to have her.
Yeah, she looks so amazing. So yeah, it's yes, great to see that you have like such great support, like from your family, and that you can like fall into that safety net after that. And your grandma is so fierce.
It saved me.
I love your grandma.
I know. She's the best. I miss her. I hate that she's in Europe. It's really bumming me out because I wish that I could see her, but COVID is, mm-hmm. you know, she's in her 80s. She's not flying anytime soon.
Yeah.
And so I miss her a lot, but like my mom did so many extraordinary things that I actually learned while I read her book. And that was after I came out. And one of them is she started a foundation before I was even out that was offering resources and therapy to anyone who had left a high control group, but specifically NXIVM defectors. And so there was a lot of people who got therapy because of my mom or were able to have a place to live because of my mom,
wow.
even before, while I was still in. And That's so incredible. We are now working together on this foundation. It's called the Katherine Oxenberg Foundation, to try to bring more money and resources so that other people can have what my mom gave me, which was just the gift of healing. And so many people leave cults and they have no money. They have no connection to their previous careers or family because they've cut it all off. And it's so hard to start your life again. So I hope that we can make that successful.
That's amazing. Yeah. So now like there's so many questions I still have, but I don't want to eat up all your time. Can I ask a couple more?
We can talk. Yeah.
Sorry. Cause I feel like. Okay.
I was like, if we need another talk in the new year, we can do that too. If we have more to discuss.
Thank you. Honestly, like it's so, I'm so fascinated by all of this and you're so great to talk to. So
oh,
it's like,
it.
It's so hard to not, I don't want to bombard you though. So I wrote down things cause I didn't want to forget. Cause sometimes I'm like, fuck, I should ask that. Did you ever sneak out to go do anything while you lived up there in Albany? And then you're like, oh, like I want to get away and go do this like fun thing. And I know like, you know what I mean? Like I'm going to go sneak off and go do this. What was it?
Yeah. Okay. I did a couple of them actually. Well, it's weird to think because at the time, I think I was 25 or 26 and I was living in Albany, and kind of the only way that we could get away with going to New York was if it was related to enrollment. So if you're like, oh, I've been working really hard and I set up some enrollment meetings and they're all in New York City or they're in Los Angeles, and they would like give you permission to leave and to go. I'm talking about Allison Mack here. Mm-hmm. And so I remember there were two trips that I made where I lied that I was going for recruitment, but really I was meeting a guy. And I was so scared to tell Allison, and I freaking thought that she would just find out, like she was some psychic or something, and she would just smell it on me and know that I was doing something bad. She didn't, but I ended up like sleeping with this guy in New York City and feeling like, what the hell did I just do? They're going to find out. I'm going to get in so much trouble. And I didn't tell anybody. I only told my one friend who I mentioned before, who I made that pact with to go speak at sentencing, because she was like my close girlfriend who kind of, we got each other. And then I did it again when I went to visit
a different guy,
family, a different guy, and some guy that I had known like from high school or something. And I feel like it was just my way of asserting a little bit of free will. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going to do this and no one's going to find out and I can do whatever I want, which unfortunately was not the case in DOS at all. But it was like, I think I kind of felt like desperate, like I was trying to just assert some sense of control or anonymity or something in my life. And so I ended up just sleeping with those two random guys. I mean, nothing came of it, but it was just, and afterwards I was like, why did I even do it? Both were really terrible in bed. Sorry. But and I was like not having good experiences, obviously, in Albany, being, you know, in a horribly weird sexual thing with Keith that I felt uncomfortable with every time. So I thought maybe these guys would make me feel better about my own sexuality, because I thought that I was kind of broken or fucked up. And both times I was so scared that they were going to see my brand. I remember being like, oh yeah, I really prefer, you know, let's just have sex in the dark.
Yeah.
Like, I was just trying so hard to conceal this other part of my life. I felt like I was living two different worlds. And I can relate so much to your AA reference, because I feel that way myself in a lot in my own healing and recovery, is that there's certain triggers that I intentionally avoid. There's certain people who I've totally cut out of my life because they're still loyal to the group.
Yeah.
And that is really difficult. And I also think, like, this is just going to be a part of my life. Like, healing from this will be continual. It won't always be bad. It's like 12 steps. You just
one day at
go
a time.
Through it, and you know, one day at a time. And I don't really think about it like, oh, I'm totally healed now and I can do whatever I want, because that's not how this stuff works. Like, there's always stuff bubbling up that needs to be looked at.
Yeah. And I'm sure, like, a memory will come up and you'll be like, oh, there's more work to be done. Like, I feel like there's always more work to be done with anything. Like, and I'm sure, like, a lot of this stuff, like for me, like, my own personal work that I do in therapy, like, there's like, everything is like tied into my fucking childhood, of course, you know what I mean? And it's like all of these, like, and it's like, damn, like, still, like, and it always, like, takes me back there, you know? It's like, it's crazy how it's like, there's just so much to, like, uncover, I feel like, in therapy in general, with even, like, your life outside of this. And I'm sure it, like, ties into all this stuff.
I think even just being in a relationship brings up so much. And I avoided that for as long as I could, because I thought that was going to be the thing that was going to trap me. And that I would feel stuck and I would feel, like, re-traumatized by it. What I didn't realize is that's called an unhealthy relationship.
Yeah.
Like, in a healthy relationship, you don't feel trapped. You feel like you're your own person. You make your own decisions. Sure, the other person can make you upset or whatnot, but you can share it and you can get over it. That was not the case in an abusive relationship or dynamic like it was. So, learning.
Yeah. And then... I was going to ask you, how do you, and you don't have to answer this, but how do you feel about the way that some of the people in the vow were depicted? Do you feel like it was truthful? Like, do you feel like they kind of catered to making it look good?
Well, that's a good question. I haven't had a lot of contact with many of the people that were in the vow. And I actually haven't watched it yet because I was trying to just stay focused on Seduced. But I think that all of those people are really, really brave. And what they did before I was even out was extraordinarily difficult and scary for them. And I think mostly they're just trying to restart their lives, and they're trying to get back to what they lost. And all of us lost a ton of time, a ton of money, and other things, and we're still trying to heal from that. And NXIVM has created a lot of messes for people and their personal relationships and their ability to get work and whatnot. So for me, I think that it's fair. I think that the vow is fair, and it gives more of that overarching overview of NXIVM even before I was involved. And so they did a really good job at explaining that. And they focus more on the whistleblowers and the people who brought this to the world's attention through the New York Times with my mother. And Seduced really focus on the survivors and on the misogyny and on what it was like to be on the inside of DOS. And so it's just a different angle. And I think it really spoke to a lot of people because it was so personal.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like I appreciated how personal it was as well. Okay. Two questions. And then I'll let you go if that's okay.
Okay. Sure.
I don't want to say I'll let you go. Is that, I'm like careful about everything I'm saying. No. What was
I'll release you?
I know. In my head about.
I love that you're a comedian because we can joke about this stuff. That is a huge part of healing, by the way, is just being able to laugh at yourself. Like I even remember asking somebody for permission to do something. I was like, oh, can I do this? And I was like, what the hell am I doing? I don't have to ask you shit. I was like, I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
So I think you have to laugh.
Wait, was Keith actually funny? Like, I feel like, or you know, like how you see like people like laughing at, like I've watched so many different cult documentaries and I feel like something I always seen common is like the head person, the guru, whatever you want to call him. Like he always says some like little joke and everyone like thinks it's so funny. Like,
I wouldn't say that he's the, like a funny guy. I think that was maybe a lot of politeness and, sure. At times he made kind of like perverted jokes. Which not to laugh at.
I was like, wait, what?
But there are other times where he made really perverted jokes that are like horrible and they don't land. And people are still kind of like crickets, or maybe one person laughs because they're so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But he wasn't like a comedian. I think who was more funny was Lauren. Lauren Salzman had a really great sense of humor and she was a very good performer. I feel really sad about Lauren's story actually. She was more charismatic. He was charismatic in his own way because that's how he attracted people, but he wasn't all that funny.
What was your
he was goofy?
Yeah, totally.
Like he walked with a limp and
a real limp,
like small, like a real limp in his knee.
How tall was he?
And I think he's only about 5'6", 5'7". So he's little.
Yeah. What was your, I'm just thinking about him. That's why I'm laughing. What? Not your type. Yeah. No one's type.
I said not my type.
No one's type.
I mean, some people, but at least there's someone for everyone out there, but not Keith Raniere, unless he has a very nice roommate in Brooklyn.
Oh yeah, right. what was your big like breaking point, bottom line, like when did everything kind of come to a head and you're like, I'm done?
Was there like a specific late. I wish it was sooner,
but was there like
there
a
wasn't speci- one okay. moment there wasn't one moment and I think some people have that, and I've heard that described in other kind of cult situations or even abusive situations where they're like the walls just shattered and I knew the truth.
Yeah,
that wasn't how it was for me. It was more just stages and layers of truths that accumulated to then finding those tapes where Keith was saying what the brand was going to be and what the sacrificial ceremony was going to look like and how he wanted it to look consensual. When I heard that, I could not rationalize it as good anymore at all. Like that was a huge defining moment for me in seeing NXIVM and Keith and DOS for what it really was.
I can't believe you found those.
I know, that was like divine.
Wow. So going forward on a more positive note, I know you just like took a trip with a pizza oven.
Oh yeah, I did. That's why we couldn't speak last week. So my last week was, I went with Patrick to Texas and we picked up a truck in order to tow a mobile wood fire oven that we towed from the South all the way back to LA so we can do pop-up outdoor pizzas.
Oh, fun.
And I love working with food. Yeah. So it should be, well, we can do like private events or pop up on the street. We're still working on getting the machine all running perfectly, but it's beautiful and it's enormous. And I hope that it can work out in COVID because everything is so restricted. So we're working on that. And and I'm his assistant.
I love that. Because I remember in the beginning, you had talked about wanting to have a baking business. Like, does this itch that scratch for you kind of thing?
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. Because it's not, it doesn't, all the weight doesn't land on me. It mostly is on him because he's the pizza chef.
Yeah.
And so I get to just be the person that takes money and interacts with people and passes the food, which is a great job for me. And it definitely scratches my food itch.
How often do you guys eat pizza? Does he make it all the time?
A lot. He makes it a lot. And his day job right now is at a pizza place in Venice.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can go in there anytime and eat a pizza. I try not
to. That's
so fun. But it's... But mostly we've mostly been cooking at home, and yeah. He has two little ovens that he uses it.
That's practice. So fun. I want a pizza oven.
Yeah. We usually sometimes it makes too many. We just give them to our neighbors in our building and run down the hallway of the apartment and be like, hey, you want a pepperoni? Like,
that's so fun.
So then we'll eat them all.
I love it. Healing through food. Right?
Exactly. Well, it really does. It works.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking the time and coming on. It was so fun to get to meet with you and over Zoom and interview and thank you for just being so open and honest and authentic. And I think, you know, this really helps so many people. So you're doing, you know, good work with everything. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It was so fun.
Yeah.
I feel like I worked up a sweat.
I'm so... Did you see that?
I know. Soaked.
I'm sweating. I have the hugest sweat stain.
I can imagine.
No, I got this natural deodorant from a company for free to try and post on my Instagram. And I was like, oh, I'll do a detox thing. And it does not work. Like, I'm just like,
you should do.
I'm sweating so much.
Not for them.
I can't stop sweating. I'm gonna have to go back to the regular.
But let me see. I used a natural too, at Palms, and it does not stop you from sweating, and it really doesn't really stop the stink that much.
Yeah.
But it's better than just straight BO.
Yeah, it's I was like, oh, I'll detox my body during this time. And because I was using men's deodorant for 15 years. And I was like, oh, clean out my body, you know, whatever. And it's not working.
Good thing we're working from home and no one has to smell us.
I know. Thank you, India. Appreciate it.
Thank you.